You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
The Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this fine Tuesday. We're homing in on Holy Week. Holy Week is next week, if you can believe that. And we've been, I hope we've had a prosperous Lent, a fruitful Lent. Prosperous is perhaps not exactly the word we're looking for, but spiritually prosperous. So treasures in heaven. We're here today, wanted to have a special guest on our Tuesday show, and today I'm having two special guests, as well as when we can finally reach him, we will also have Mr. Michael Litchens with us. But today, wanted to welcome to the show Jean-Marc and Teresa Grody. If the name Grody sounds familiar to you, and the Mark in Jean-Marc sounds familiar to you, that's because Jean-Marc is the son of Marcus Grody, and is actually works with his dad on. He's the chief operating officer of the Coming Home Network. So you've probably seen him if you watch EWTN. You've seen him interviewed on EWTN programs like Life on the Rock and The Journey Home, as well as a bunch of different radio programs. He's a grad student of philosophy at Franciscan University at Steubenville, lives in Perrysburg, Ohio with Teresa, and they've got three kidlets. How old are your kidlets?
5, 3, 1, and one on the way.
Oh, well, congratulations. And anyway, so he's a big fan of Chesterton, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, so we have, you know, a lot to talk about. Teresa's mom taking care of three kids and the one on the way lives in Perrysburg with Jean-Marc, and
she's got her
got her BA and MA in history at Bowling Green State University, and she organizes pilgrimages for Catholic Faith Journeys. You can find them online at the creatively named CatholicFaithJourneys.com. And also big fan of Lewis and Chesterton and Tolkien. So I want to welcome you guys to the show. How's it going?
Good, Mark. Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm excited to talk for an hour to adults.
Yeah. We have a babysitter, so this is great.
So don't tell me you put on like the Emperor's New Groove and the kids are in the other room.
Am I right? we went away. My mom's watching the kids.
Oh, okay. Well, that was it. Yeah. See, that's very nice. We do that for our guys too.
Nice.
Kids come over to our house, and we're having a big birthday party on Saturday for Seraphim. She's our 3-year-old granddaughter, and, or will be 3 on Saturday. So,
aww.
That's a great name. Gotta add that one to the list.
I know. We're struggling with boys' names.
Boys' names. Well, let's see. My son Matthew, who's Seraphim's dad, for years, his big plan, if he had boys, his top three names were Ramrod, Bomb Squad, and The Stump. So,
our kids prefer Luke Skywalker.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's,
well, our oldest son is named Luke. So, so I was particularly fond of The Stump. I thought that would be interesting.
Yeah, I feel like there's maybe a story behind that I'll love to hear some other time.
it's just Matthew's creative mind. So there you go. So you've been working for Coming Home Network International. How long have you been doing that?
I've been working, you know, close to full time for over 10 years now. Okay. I've been in various capacities over the years, and I've been going, you know, to conferences and stuff with my dad ever since he became Catholic when I was 5. So that's been quite a while now.
Okay.
But yeah, it's been over the years, I started kind of on the communications end of things, and then slowly have just gotten more and more involved with the rest of the work. And mm-hmm. you know, we've moved our, we have more of a kind of a virtual staff now. We've got, you know, you talked to Matt Swaim recently. He's out in D.C. and mm-hmm. We've got a couple offices here in Ohio and a guy in Maine and a guy in California. So as we've moved to more of a spread out staff and moved online with a lot of our operations and our materials, I've gotten more and more involved.
Okay. That's cool. What's Marcus Grote I really like anyway?
he's a great grandpa.
Yeah, he's a great grandpa.
I bet he is. Well, you know, that was one of the things that I always loved about your dad was I did his show several times, mm-hmm. and he is exactly the same on the air as he is off the air. He's just the same guy, right? There's no artifice there, you know. Right. I remember the first time I did his show when they said okay and we're out. He looked at me and goes, "Okay, you want to go get a beer?"
Yeah. Yeah, he's really I think what people might not get as much from it is that he is really a hobbit. We're kind of a family of hobbits. On my side of the family, Teresa and her family are quite a bit more outgoing and extroverted. But
yeah, we're more like the Jenningses from Sense and Sensibility. pretty intense family.
Okay.
But yeah, he's a pretty regular guy. So
that's fantastic. Yeah, it was one of the things that endeared him to me was just that there's nothing fake about the guy. Mm-hmm. He's just the same guy all the time. And I love that, you know, his first instinct on becoming, by the way, here is a little connection that I have with your dad. Mm-hmm. Your dad was received into the church 5 years to the day after I was.
Oh, wow.
I discovered that in a conversation with him one time.
Cool.
Really? Which is also weird because December 20th is a weird day to enter the church. Mm-hmm. But So there you go. But I love that was his first instinct when he entered the church was to immediately start thinking about the challenges faced by other people and especially pastors.
Right.
You know, coming into the Catholic Church, it's a really hard transition. How many people are part of the Coming Home Network now?
Well, there's many ways, different ways to slice it because the network is composed of, people who are on the journey, you know, both clergy and lay people on the journey. There's all the converts that we worked with over the years. There are many, many, many more converts who have just joined post-conversion and are just, you know, supporters and readers of the network. As well as, you know, many, many Catholics, you know, who generously support the mission over the years. Mm-hmm. And so, there are tens of thousands on our mailing list, you know, and who are in our database as members. But in terms of, you know, down to the numbers of people that we're working with, you know, last year, as an example, around 2,000 new, you know, recent converts, journeyers and the like, inquirers, you know, contacted the network. So people who, have recently become Catholic, people who are on the journey, you know, some about 200 to 300 of those were pastors, again, who had recently become Catholic or who are actively thinking about becoming Catholic. And so, you know, that's the sort of thing that we're working with. And those numbers are really up from previous years. This is actually this past year has been the highest numbers across the types of membership that we've ever had. And so that's increasing. But those are kind of where we stand in generally with the numbers.
Hmm. Well, that's phenomenal. I mean, it's an amazing thing because there just wasn't anything especially for clergy before the Coming Home Network began. If you wanted to enter the church and you were clergy in some other tradition, it's just good luck. Hope you can find a job as a house painter or whatever, you know?
It was so interesting as like a cradle Catholic to marry John Mark and just by association get involved with volunteering with the Coming Home Network. And I started editing the conversion stories when they'd come in for a little while. And it was something that had never occurred to me that a pastor that wasn't Catholic would become Catholic. And then B, what that would mean for that person to they're radically following Jesus Christ. I mean, this person could very well be living in the house that the church provides. You know, maybe they were somebody who, you know, at 18 went into seminary and their only upper level education is in being their religion, you know, and just the thought that this person is losing everything, essentially becoming a refugee to come into the Catholic Church. And I never even give them, I didn't even know they existed. Like it's such a unique ministry.
And so often too, the church on the local level, is people have mixed experiences, when they approach, you know, a local parish or a parish staff member or a priest and let them know that they're thinking about becoming Catholic. Many times the person just has never encountered that before and is a little flabbergasted by it. And generally speaking, pastors, as they approach the church is still working out its pastoral approach to these people because it's really a new situation in history that we're encountering. Lots of these people who, again, this is 500 years after the Reformation. These are people who grew up in other traditions, you know, spent their whole life following Christ in that tradition. And then usually it's not till, you know, mid or later in life that they have this, they begin studying and they have this experience and they decide to become Catholic. And and that's a new situation that oftentimes we're unprepared to really help them with.
Yeah. Yeah. There's kind of, you know, they're following the footsteps of people like Cardinal Newman. You know, and Newman, you know, what resources did he have? There was nothing. I mean, you know, so yeah, it's wonderful the work that you're doing. We are chatting today with John Mark and Teresa Grody of the Coming Home Network, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. Back in a minute.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Dots. I am your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with our special guests, John Mark and Teresa Grody. John Mark is the son of Marcus Grody, who is the founder of Coming Home Network International, and he, in fact, works with Coming Home Network International. Teresa is his wife. They have three kids here and one on the way. And they are busy, busy bees. John Mark, in addition to his work at Coming Home Network, is also, he's a grad student at Franciscan University in philosophy, did you say?
Yeah, yeah.
And Teresa's got her BA and MA in history, which helps, that helps to make you a better Catholic, because, you know, deep in history. To be deep in history, said Newman, was to cease to be a Protestant.
It was actually kind of funny the first year of our marriage, figuring out this philosopher being married to a historian thing.
Yeah.
And we would find that usually the fights, and I say fights loosely because neither of us are fighters, the things that we would just get stuck in, we started to realize that one of us was thinking of the ideal and the other was thinking of like the application.
You can guess which was which.
I think I can guess which was which. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Well, I had a friend who actually lives out in Ohio, teaches at Ohio University, a guy named Dave Kerp. And Dave was raised as a Protestant, but the longer he studied history and the history of the church, the way he put it finally was he hit the point where he realized he could be a Protestant or a Christian, but not both anymore. So he opted for Christian and became a Catholic. And yeah, so anyway, talk a bit more about the work of the Coming Home Network. It used to be the Coming Home Network, and then it became the Coming Home Network International, which is a hopeful sign. You know, you're doing work globally now. Are you doing work? Is it primarily in the Anglosphere, or are you doing work in among other nationalities and tribes and tongues as well?
Yeah, I'm not. I don't think there was ever an intentionality about a name change. We do primarily work in the Anglosphere, just because that's sort of the size of our apostolate. Still, we haven't really been able to break out in a real intentional way. We do have some people here and there from different languages, and there are people who do speak English around the world. We have people in the Philippines that we've talked a lot to. Primarily it's been in the Anglosphere.
Okay. I've got a friend who you guys actually should probably connect with.
Yeah.
Her name is Trisha Bula. Mm-hmm. She is a lay Catholic missionary doing mission work all over Asia. Mm-hmm. So she's the founder of the St. Francis Xavier Society for Lay Evangelization. Mm-hmm. Is just going great guns everywhere in Asia.
Very cool.
Doing all kinds of interesting things. And that involves, of course, a lot of work with missionaries from other traditions as well.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about our work, I always have, you know, especially as we talk about, you know, the international aspect, we talk about these big global missions, you know, and of course the whole world is moving toward bigness, you know, at a huge rate, globalization and the interconnectedness of the media and all that. Yeah. And of course, one of the difficulties that the tendency is for people to become numbers, for relationships and connections to be depersonalized. You know, I think there's even a tendency with our, even in our Catholic media, with a lot of the very good information out there, it's still very easy to begin to just talk to people as a group, you know, to our apologetics, just to be talking to this nameless, faceless group of people out there.
Right.
And so that's a tendency, a pitfall for people who are evangelizing these days. And our work is decidedly personalist. You know, every time somebody comes to us, we recognize that it's a work of grace that in their Christian walk, they're contemplating a next step. A next turn closer to Jesus. And so, you know, we take each person and just do our absolute best to be a good steward of that opportunity and to help them and to pray for them. Even if, you know, even if they don't decide to become Catholic, you know, many stall out or they, you know, things happen and we don't pronounce judgment on them. We keep praying for them. We keep connected with them as much as we can. Mm-hmm. And so it's that personalist aspect of the network, especially in face of the way that the world is going, I think is unique and important.
So what happened? I mean, okay, so I am, you know, I can give you an example. In fact, you might know him. You might have connected with him. A friend of mine named Jason Stellman. You familiar with Jason?
Yeah, we talked to him when he was still on the journey.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, he's an example. This is a guy who, you know, you mentioned people whose entire educational background had been nothing but preparation for becoming a pastor in their particular tradition. That was exactly Jason's thing. He was a guy who had become a Presbyterian pastor. Oh, excuse me.
Pardon me.
Oh, bless you.
Don't you love that when people sneeze on the air? Jason became a Presbyterian pastor and then had hit this crisis where he'd come to realize, yikes, you know, the Catholic Church is right and I'm wrong and I have to become a Catholic. And now what do I do? I mean, you hear from these guys all the time. So say I've got listeners out there who are agonizing about this question. Sure. What does the Coming Home Network do for them?
Sure. Well, the first thing is that if you visit www.chnetwork.org, you know, our whole website is a place for the sort of information that a person like that may need. We have inspiring stories, you know, and some, you know, some apologetics as here and there, and some good links and resources there to get people started. But the main thing that we want to do is we want people to connect with us individually, especially if they're on the journey. If they're thinking about becoming Catholic, we want to make sure that they have some real life connections to other Christians who are Catholic as they contemplate this journey. And so, you know, if they fill out a registration form or contact us to be, you know, become a member of the network, one of our pastoral care staff, Jim Anderson or Mary Claire Pazinski or Brother Rex Norris or Ken Hensley, will reach out to them personally, directly. Get to know them a bit better, hear more of their story, and find out what their needs are, whether they just need prayers, whether they need, they're working through some doctrinal issues, whether they need some connections. You know, we look through our network and see, you know, are there any priests or other members or apologists or just good friends of the network on the local level that we can connect them to. Mm-hmm. We invite them into our online community. We have, you know, online forums, you know, that are safe and moderated and private groups and you know, and again, they have a staff member who just sticks with them and tries to figure out what their needs are. And then we just, as a team, do whatever we can to help them on their journey. And then even after they become Catholic, you know, we usually have a little welcome gift for them, and we follow up with them and see how they're, you know, they're settling into the church. You know, it doesn't obviously end as soon as you become Catholic. That's just the starting gun for the rest of your life of walk of faith. And there's still a lot of cultural changes and things that you encounter, especially when the ideal of Catholicism meets the reality of actually, you know, living in a parish and joining a community. You know, there are things that come up. So, yeah, we just try to be there for people and you know, meet various needs that come to us.
Okay. Have you had, I mean, you know, some of your clergy are, I presume, are Anglican clergy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you had any of them? Because I know that some Anglican clergy have actually sought ordination as Catholic priests.
Right.
So, in fact, I think Father Dwight Longenecker was one of those guys.
Yeah.
Have you had some members of the Coming Home Network do that?
Yeah. We our chaplain for the longest time was the late Father Ray Ryland, which I'm not sure if you've connected with him. In the
oh
past.
Yeah, I remember him. Yep.
I believe he was the one of the very early priests. I have my terms goofy now. Either the pastoral provision or in the Anglican ordinariate when it was started. I can't remember which one of those. But he was one of the early, you know, Anglican married priests who came in and saw ordination was granted that. We've had many since then, and we have, you know, good connections with the Ordinariate, and Monsignor Jeffrey Steenson is a good, very good friend and advisor of ours. He was the Ordinary for the Ordinariate for a long time. So, yeah, we've had lots of Anglican. Actually, I just recently, in a visit out to the West Coast, I and a colleague had lunch. We were able to meet with one of our contacts directly. We don't often get to do that, but we had lunch with this Anglican pastor who had contacted us and was thinking about making the journey. And we got together a group of Catholic friends from that area and had a good lunch with him. So, yeah, it's great to hear from them. And it's nice that for the Anglicans, there is a bit more of a path in the church. The church is sort of thinking ahead on, you know, when Anglicans seek full communion with the church. You know, we try to fill in with the rest because, you know, for other pastors, oftentimes there's not quite that pastoral situation yet.
Yeah. Well, how about other pastors? What, you know, you got a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds. Are there chances? I remember a few years ago. Oh, well, we're up against a break, but we'll be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. Your host, Mark Shea. We are third day with John Mark, Teresa Grody, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
backwards. Connecting the dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're talking today with John-Mark Grodi and his wife, Teresa. And by the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. If you want to join the conversation and talk to, you know, the heir of the House of Grodi. doesn't that sound impressive when you put it?
The Hobbit Hole. The heir of the Hobbit Hole of Grodi.
Yeah, the heir of the Hobbit Hole of Grodi. yes. you should announce yourself that way from now on.
That's I think I'm going to. I'm going to adopt that.
Yes. You have reached the heir of the House of Grodi. I am John Mark, son of Marcus. So that would be super cool. I would leave a message even if I were just like a Maytag repairman, you know. Just, I feel obliged to say something.
You know, we used to do something like that to make friends. We had a custom bumper sticker made that said, "Read the C.S. Lewis Space Trilogy," and then it listed the three books. And we just figured, well, if we can find people who have read this, then we can become friends with them and talk about the book.
Figured either people will ignore it, you know, and think we're weird, or they'll ask us about it and we'll have identified someone that we need to get to know better.
Well, plus, the great thing about that is that that's a bumper sticker that would fit on a bumper. If you put on the whole, you know, like, read the collected works of G.K. Chesterton, you'd have to, like, it would have to be a bumper sticker that, like, covered your back window and then went down your trunk.
We thought about this bumper sticker for a long time.
That is exceedingly nerdly, and I am honored to have you on my show.
I'm so surprised how few people have read C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy.
I love that thing.
It is so good, and it is so creepily relevant to so many things going on in the world today.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. Yeah, Weston in particular. I mean, what's really great about that trilogy is that he succeeds in taking Weston, who is just hilariously pompous, in the first book. There's this, for those who are not familiar with it, it's C.S. Lewis creates a character who is actually based on his friend J.R.R. Tolkien, who becomes the hero of this book, and he gets swept off to Mars.
Ransom.
Ransom is his name. And Ransom gets swept off to Mars, and along with the bad guy, Weston. And Ransom is a philologist, like Tolkien was. Mm-hmm. And so he makes friends with the Martians because he's interested in learning their language, because language is what interests him. Weston is just this sort of old school, you know, if you put him on Earth, you'd put on a pith helmet and he'd go to Africa and then just start shooting anything that moved indiscriminately. because he's here to bring superior Western civilization to the savages.
Exactly.
And so he goes to Mars to bring superior Western civilization to the savages. There's a really tragic moment where Ransom is talking to one of the Martians and he hears a shot, and he said it was a familiar sound. It was, in fact, it was even European. It was the sound of a rifle. And then the Martian that he's talking to collapses because he's been shot by Weston. Anyway, there's this big scene at the end where Ransom, who's the only character who's actually learned any of the local languages, he and Weston are brought before a tribunal of what are essentially the angels that rule Mars. Mm-hmm. Weston is asked a bunch of questions, but because Weston can't speak any of the local languages, Ransom has to translate for him. And so Weston gives these big speeches that you've read in books by people like H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
About, you know, because of our superior law and medicine. And then Ransom goes, okay, just a minute. I have to translate this into their language. And so the translation is, sometimes members of our species get bent and do awful things, and so we have to put them in cages, and other times their bodies break, and so we have to try to fix them. Because that's what law and medicine means, right? And anyway, so Weston gives this giant, this big speech full of flourishes about our inevitable triumph and marching across the universe and stuff. And then, you know, Weston has to, or Ransom has to translate it into, well, we think we're better than you, so we get to kill you and take your stuff, you know? Anyway, that character, who is hilarious in the first book, in the second book, literally becomes possessed by Satan. Yeah. And is just the most terrifying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think I knew horror until I read these books, particularly at the end of the very last book. Yeah. And I mean, I used to take film classes, and I think I even took a horror class. So I've watched a lot of fun Japanese horror films in my day. But, you know, they're so chilling. And what has to be a spiritual aspect to these books is that when you're reading Lewis's description of just the absolute gruesomeness of, particularly, you know, in the last book, that hideous strength at the end, where there's just carnage, and you get this feeling of, I don't want to be on that side. I want to be on this other side. And this side, thinking of myself on that side, is the most horrific. And not just because they're meeting terrible ends, but because they're mentally driven to those ends.
Yeah, well, he does such a great job with his evil characters in that hideous strength of you know, kind of showing this self-consuming nature of these ideas that leave them open to sort of spiritual attack, and then how they just sort of unravel as they go.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, I think I've read that Hideous Strength maybe 7 or 8 times.
Yeah.
More than the rest of.
Well, there's so many good themes to be dug out of it. You know, theology, the body stuff. You know, aspects of the modern media. I mean, it's so much of it is Lewis's abolition of man, sort of writ into fiction. It's just excellent.
Yes, it is. It really is. And I agree with you completely. Yeah, it's. I'm glad those books exist. I've read them. I can't tell you how many times I've read that series, and now you're making me want to go back and read
them. I know. Once a year, I usually pick it up again.
Yeah, they're really, really they're profound and great fun as well.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask you. Now, this is a point of contest between Jemmerk and I. I don't know. Yes. Okay. I don't know how to say that. I'm pregnant. My brain doesn't work.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and see you right there, now, Therese.
How would you cast
the
fairy, Miss Hardcastle? Which Hollywood actress would you pick to cast her?
These are the parlor games in my family. We cast C.S. Lewis books into
C.S. Lewis books. You know, well, she'd have to be. Bulky, I think. Kind of a little bit hairy.
Ooh.
I think, but that can all be done with makeup and so forth.
And now with that, how they put video games on people's faces now, and it looks like real people.
Yeah. Or they just they resurrected Peter Cushing from the dead for Rogue One.
Rogue One, and then of course you had the creepy Uncanny Valley Leia Skywalker too.
Leia.
Yeah. Sorry. What was that? Did you say Leia?
I did.
He always does.
I am appalled. I'm shocked.
And it's not like he could run.
No, I don't know. I'm not sure who. I mean, just one name that springs to mind, but she's not quite right, would be Kathy Bates.
Oh, see? Now, it's the lady from The Office who takes over Dunder Mifflin.
It's the British woman?
No, not Donna Noble. But, okay, so John Mark sees more of a... What's that woman's name?
Well, here's my thing with it. And this is getting in sort of like literary film stuff, but I think things work differently in text than they do on film. And I think the part of the chilling nature of that particular, again, Lewis has these masterful sort of evil characters, and the particularly chilling nature of her character is that she's sort of, she's this feminine character who sort of rejected everything about her femininity, which is thematically familiar. I think in text, he can describe her as more of sort of a boorish figure in that. But I feel like visually on film that you won't really open the can of worms here.
I'll tell you.
We'll be back in just a minute, and then we'll get to find out the casting choices for That Hideous Strength, which, if you have not read it, you really should. But first, you have to read Out of the Silent Planet and Perelandra. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm Mark Shea. We're here today with John Mark Grodi and Teresa Grodi, and we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with John Mark and Teresa Grodi. And we got kind of pleasantly derailed into a mutual love of ours, which is...
this is where we were intending to go with this. You've been had.
Yeah, I was going to say, they came on the show, they said... Look, we'll talk about the stupid Coming Home Network for as short time as possible, but then let's get on to the stuff that we really care about, the space trilogy.
Exactly.
So we're talking about C.S. Lewis's space trilogy. I, for one, am dying to know who you would cast as Fairy Hardcastle from That Hideous Strength.
Okay. Well, have you ever seen Matilda?
Yeah. Oh, this is Trunchbull.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So, because John Mark, I think, sees more of a Helena Bonham Carter, but I don't see her as that.
Yeah.
Well, she's disgusting.
John Mark.
But she thinks she's...
It's the old literary maxim that the most evil things are the good things twisted, and I think in pure text form, you telling this story, obviously you don't actually have to see her. You're just imagining her. And so you can still get sort of the twisted femininity. But I feel like on screen, if you picked someone who was too kind of laughably boorish, all the real chilling, really evil nature of the character would kind of be gone, because it would just be more of a joke at how, look how mannish this character is, rather than, no, this is someone who's thoroughly rejected her femininity and loves to rub it in everyone's faces.
Now, I'm going to go ahead and say that Teresa's completely right and that you're wrong. And
yeah, I'll go with that, too.
There's this Italian movie, I think, called Seven Brothers or something like that. But they have a Nazi guard woman, and mm-hmm. she plays this part so well. Mm. It's not worth watching the show.
Well, you know, the woman that plays Mrs. Trunchbull, who's got like the monobrow and everything. She's just so great. But she was the woman that played the nasty fat aunt in one of the Harry Potter movies. The one who gets blown up and floats away.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. She did. Huh?
Yeah.
And so she could do that. She's really good. She that is Fairy Hardcastle.
That's who
Ding ding ding. You guys win.
I've issued my verdict and no man could stand against it. Casting those films or making those films would be really, really interesting. I don't think it'd be possible to do it.
Yeah, it's probably better than
it's not. It's probably better that it's not. Yeah,
everybody's
that
naked in Perelandra.
Yeah, there's that detail.
Well, there is that problem too, is everybody's running around naked in Perelandra. But it's Eden, man. I mean, you get to do that in Eden.
Yeah, we have CGI now. I'm sure people can. That's what that's called, right?
Just
CGI.
Fig leaves having to floating by at the right
time. If they did Avatar, they can do parallel.
Carefully placed foliage. That's right. That's what you need. So yeah, they did Avatar. So it's all doable. But well, golly, that ran far afield, but
we have a quote that'll bring it back.
Okay. Hit me. I'm ready for the quote.
Okay. Here's our very most favorite quote from That Hideous Strength. And it's it relates to a lot of what people experience in the modern media. So Ferry Hardcastle, the character we're talking about, is asking Mark, the protagonist, to write some propagandist stuff for the newspapers to convince the common people of this political party action that's going on. And she says, don't you understand anything? Isn't it absolutely essential to keep a fierce left and a fierce right both on their toes, each terrified of the other? That's how we get things done. Any opposition to the NICE is represented as a left racket in the right papers and a right racket in the left papers. If it's properly done, you get each side outbidding the other in support of us to refute the enemy slanders. Of course, we're non-political. The real power always is. And the protagonist replies, I don't believe you can do that. Not in the papers that are read by educated people. And the enemy, Ferry Hardcastle replies, why, you fool? It is the educated reader who can be gold. All of our difficulty comes with the others. When did you meet a workman who believes the papers? He takes it for granted that they're all propaganda and skips the leading articles. He buys his paper for the football results and the little paragraphs about girls falling out of windows and corpses found in Mayfair flats. He is our problem. We have to recondition him. But the educated public, the people who read the highbrow weeklies, don't need reconditioning. They're all right already. They'll believe anything.
Yep. And that was true when he wrote those in the early 40s. Problem is, now people don't get their information from newspapers. They get it from television. And
right.
It's fed visually. All you have to do is just have a picture and juxtapose it with some other picture of something nasty.
Right.
And people... make these associations.
And that's the real chilling thing about the quote, because again, the first reaction is, well, that may have been the case then, but you know, who's the common person nowadays? And the problem is that through the media and the education system, everybody feels part of the educated class. Everybody's in the know. Everybody's well-informed and well-connected. And so everybody sort of feels above this influence. But the whole point of this quote is that it's those people who think that they're above the influence that really don't recognize how much they've bought into it.
Right.
I was thinking about this lately. Actually, I was driving with Dad and another Journey Home guest, and we were talking about commercials, and he was making the joke about, he'd seen this one commercial, but he didn't remember afterwards what the commercial was about. And so must have been a bad commercial because I don't remember what they were selling me. And I was thinking about it afterwards and about how, well, that's maybe true in a sense. But, you know, one of the things about commercials, about the media these days, is it even if we don't remember what the thing is, and we feel above the influence because I didn't buy the car, so I must be above the influence of this marketing. Mm-hmm. But I've learned to think in terms of 30-second bite-sized emotive pieces. The media doesn't succeed when it sells us on one particular thing. It succeeds by teaching us a way of thinking. And that's what we see throughout our social media, throughout our news, that people think in quick emotive images and headlines and clickbait. And that's the problem. That's the bigger problem with the media.
Yeah. 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 Unfortunately, you know, it is. And it's the way we've been taught to process information, you know. And don't make it too long. And if you can make it visual, then do that. It's not a way of receiving information or processing information that makes you terribly critical. Another line from Lewis in his Screwtape Letters. He remarks that. Of course, you use, lots and lots of sexual imagery to sell a product because, as he puts it, a man with an obsession is a man with very little sales resistance. You know, one of my favorite, there's a lot of great lines from C.S. Lewis. One of my favorite lines from C.S. Lewis, which I've never forgotten, comes from The Magician's Nephew. Talking about Uncle Andrew is the wicked magician who first forges the magic rings that gets them into Narnia. And at one point they get to Narnia and they're surrounded by all these talking animals, and Uncle Andrew doesn't want them to be. It upsets him too much. And so he's bound and determined to not hear them able to speak. And eventually he makes himself unable to hear them speak.
Yeah.
And the way that Lewis explains it is he says, the trouble with trying to make yourself stupider than you really are is that you can very often succeed.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a life lesson and something that I've managed to be pretty good at sometimes.
Yeah, it's a great analog for sort of the media plays to our worst tendencies to sort of insulate ourselves and just, you know, constantly reaffirm and reaffirm what we already believe and feel and never have to go out beyond that in any constructive way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. Rats. And we're getting out of time. We're getting close to being out of time here. I want to go back just a little bit more and revisit the Coming Home Network, because you guys do such great work. Where can people find you? And how can they support you? And if they are themselves, if you're Protestant out there and you're thinking about becoming Catholic, here are some people that are a very huge resource. Talk about that. How can people find you?
Sure thing. Well, our website is www.chnetwork.org. And again, as the first thing you said, you know, calling all Catholics and people who have become Catholic, all converts out there, we really do need your help. I mean, there's lots and lots of people, especially this last couple of years, much more than we. Our whole goal is to give them all very personalized attention. We want to really be there for them and not just treat them as numbers. And so we do need your help in growing the network and making sure that the resources are available for them. So you can find all information about that at the Coming Home Network. But also, you know, there are lots of other ways to support us. We have a huge network of supporters in prayer. We have converts who share their powerful stories, which, you know, have such a big impact in people's lives. You know, and we have, you know, through our online community and our retreats and our other opportunities, converts and Catholics can actually be those people for other Christians who are exploring the historical Catholic faith. So then on the other side, you know, again, if you're a non-Catholic Christian, you know, I would tell you that this is the organization for you. I mean, you're going to find people who, they don't look back on their Protestant denominations with anything but gratitude for what they've been given. They look back with gratitude that people brought them to Jesus Christ. Yeah. You know, even if, you know, many of our people fell away from their Catholic faith earlier in their life and found Christ, you know, through their evangelical friends. And we praise God for that. We thank God for that. You know, we think there's a fullness, more, and we'd love to help them discover that and help them through the process. But this is the place to talk through that, to explore it. You're going to find people who are passionate about their faith who want to share it with you. So that's chnetwork.org.
Fantastic. Well, Jean-Marc and Teresa Grodi, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You guys out there in Radio Land have been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. Our producer today was the indefatigable Mr. Danny Head, and we will be back tomorrow with Rod Bennett. Until then, have a grand evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.